So, ladies and gentlemen, we'll continue in German now.
Fantastic lecture, and hopefully it's also a good introduction into what we are going to discuss right now.
As we don't have a moderator for this session, what we're going to do is enter into a dialogue. We've done a little bit of preparation, but do bear with us. We're used to working in a moderated structure with an anchor person presenting the session. But it's quite interesting. There's no hierarchy, in a sense, with the speakers having to slot into a ready-made structure. We want to talk about emancipation at the Bauhaus and about the international dimension. So we're going to move back to the question of internal contradictions and the shaping and designing of politics and gender in this session that we have now. And we're going to look at the two topics as they stand. So the first block of our discussion will look at the question of gender politics. And then the second chunk will look at the dimensions of internationalization. We'll be looking at those in the mirror of the topos of the campus, the Bauhaus as a campus. And what we'd agreed was that I would kick off. So I'll start by saying a few words about the Bauhaus and emancipation. A lot has already been addressed. It's an experiment, in a sense, here to look at various different modi of the Bauhaus historiography, to look at narratives that are constantly presented on the Bauhaus. And I'm going to try to look at the textile workshop from a somewhat oblique perspective. The idea is that everything that was female and all the women, in fact, ended up in the textile workshop. I want to undermine this notion and to demonstrate the textile workshop per se is also a locus of aesthetics and of emancipation. And as we don't have terribly much time, I'll try to focus just on a couple of aspects. There we have the controversy between art and industry. That's what design is, in a sense. I'd like to pick up the thread here, because we're talking about textiles as well, on Arjun Appadurai's lecture. The textile workshop, I would say, was a kind of circuit in which different forms and different kinds of knowledge flowed. Looking back at the weaving workshop, it's following was said it was the students who actually set the ball rolling. And there was the question of the role of who developed the school. Perhaps it was the students, in fact, who did this, as Mark Rigley underlined very clearly in his presentation. And what happened was that at the textile workshop, they moved from pictures made of wool to looking at the materials within space. And that's a very interesting dimension that many of the students picked up on. Otti Berger, for example. That was a movement then that went away from the notion that textile arts are one of the high arts, the fine arts, the visual arts, moving away from the idea that it's decorative to a new notion of the textile, moving towards the notion of material within space, and therefore the encounters run up against non-Western epistemes. And that's why I talked about a circuit. It's very interesting to see that Gunter Stelz's curriculum had visits to the ethnographic collection in Berlin. The non-Western pre-Columbian textiles were looked at there in great detail. And you can see, looking at Annie Albers' texts as well, there was really an interesting impulse there about a different way to conceive of the textile, not just as a decorative medium in the sense of, for example, tapestries and traditional European decorative textiles, but more as a medium of communication. Looking at the ethnographic collections, they realized that there was a very rich iconography and pictorography, and that hence textiles could play a very striking, distinct role. Now, the fragments that ended up in the Ethnographic Museum had a rather bloody backdrop in some cases. But this notion of rethinking and reconceiving the textile came from this circuit, moving out of the circulation of the movement of these pieces of fabric. And that was a really pronounced impetus to think differently about fabrics, about the materiality of those fabrics. And there was also how this could come into contact with life. That was a very important issue for this circuit. And the second point that it speaks in favour of the textile workshop being a locus of emancipation, I'd like to refer to the haptic and the optic. Now, that's a very interesting approach, the tactile side of things versus the level of knowledge. Otti Berger, it's interesting that I said Annie Berger, actually, Freudian slip there, one might say. So anyway, it was stated, we don't want images, we want to produce the best possible living fabric. It must be possible to understand with your hands. The value of a fabric lies in the tactile. This dimension of generation of knowledge through the tactile is something that you see within the sphere, typically of weavers. That's automatically linked to the idea of the tactile, but it's well worth looking beyond this and looking at the debate within the Bauhaus as such, the relationship between the optical and the haptic, the tactile and the visual. Tal Smith, in her book on weaving theory, addressed this. There's debates between Molinage and others. They're not just academic debates. They really touch upon the very heart of a society that was developing towards the consumer society. It was already a modern society. Much of what was found in that setting was already secondhand. There's the backdrop of the loss of the tactile element, the loss of the sense of touch. It's always undervalued socially. Molinage talked about this when talking about materials on architecture. He talked about the what he called the natural people, the peoples. They played a different role in their appraisal of the tactile. Now, if you look at the Bauhaus, you can see that it's about more than that. The question is, how can designers respond to different sensory patterns of their contemporary context when the realm of perception has changed? Walter Benjamin said this about cinema as well. He said that the visual may also have a tactile dimension. And this kind of interface is intriguing to look at how it's possible to redefine and rework the notion of the tactile. It's interesting politically as well, because the visual per se, as Hartmut Böhmer has repeatedly underlined in his research on the tactile. But the visual was, in terms of cultural history, the most important player in abstraction, linking visualization and knowledge. But we also saw the conquest of the visual arts as well. And that was linked up to a Western-oriented notion of cognition. Now, weaving, and the weaving workshop in particular, was a locus in which hybrid forms and contacts between seeing and understanding, between the tactile and the optical and visual, were perhaps negotiated. One could perhaps limit this. And now, moving on to Annie Albers in this case, if you look at Annie Albers' text that she wrote later on weaving and on designing, that is pure design theory. It's theories about making theories that reflect how giving form, the notion of design, actually comes into being. And that then gave rise to text. Now, I'm mentioning that because this event is looking at how political is the Bauhaus, how topical is it. It's no coincidence that today, in many debates, we see a different notion of design as formation, as the giving of form. The process-oriented aspect is set in the limelight, and weaving is a metaphor that occurs again and again. The most important figure here for the Anthropocene is a figure who forms a basket, indicating that a basket is only really shaped through the encounter between material and practice. And it's a tactile practice, the notion of overcoming the distinction between the subject and the object. That brings us back to the Anthropocene again as well. Weaving is a process by which that object comes into existence. That's what Ingold says. And it's well worth looking more closely at Annie Albers, who talks about the event of the thread. Precisely this idea of transition, this notion of hybridity. And I'm almost coming to the end of my comments now. It's interesting to look at Ty Smith's assertion in a recent publication. She said, with reference to Bruno Latour, the Bauhaus has never been modern.
Vielleicht noch kurz, um zu erklären, was ich überhaupt hier mache.
Maybe briefly a few words to explain what I'm doing here, because there was no introduction. I wrote a novel set at the Bauhaus. So unlike many here who've addressed the Bauhaus on a scholarly level, I addressed it through the facet of literature. Now, we heard a great deal about perversion at the Bauhaus, liberalization of relations between genders. We talked about a certain degree of gender fluidity. That's absolutely fascinating as literary subject matter. But if you write a historical novel, you have to think about why you're narrating what you're narrating, why you're talking about this period and how you're doing so. And when you look more closely, it's not so straightforward. I thought, however, that precisely this period and this setting was particularly well suited to look at more subtle forms of sexism in an elite cultural context, one that felt that it was progressive and believed itself to be part of the avant-garde. That's much more relevant today, I think, than looking back to the 1950s, because you can really so much too easily, vis-a-vis the 1950s, say that it has nothing to do with us today. Weaving, I think it's very important that we recontextualize this so that we don't just underline the stereotypes that played a role back then. Weaving as a kind of craft, we don't want to reproduce that. But it's important to note that not all of the women went to the weaving workshop on a voluntary basis. We heard from Gertrude Ann before. Not everybody ended up on a voluntary basis there. Gropius said in his inaugural speech that there was to be no distinction between the beautiful gender and the strong gender, but subsequently he strove for a clear distinction to be made, particularly given that women were overrepresented numerically. So on paper, there was supposed to be no discrimination, but that was informally then once again overturned. Most women ended up in the weaving workshop. And it's a question of cause and effect here, and the correlation between the two, of course. In 1919, there were 84 women who applied, a much smaller number of men. There was a drop off in the number of women after that, and the question is whether that had something to do with Gropius's informal reversal, of course. There's the Oscar Schlemmer statement, where there's wool, there's a woman weaving away to pass the time, or Johannes Itten saying that women did not have the capacity for 3D vision. Gerhard Marx, who dealt with the pottery department, didn't want to have any women there. for the sake of both them and the workshop per se. So I found it instructive to look at this setting. That's also because the avant-garde context is not just the illusion that one is progressive in this respect. There is the myth of the genius, which is particularly pronounced. There's a particular impact of social capital of this kind, which impinges on gender relations. And there are a lot of blind spots, really, has to be said.
Es gibt ja auch die anderen Beispiele, die.
Then there are the other examples which are interesting to look at in the Bauhaus magazine. Women, for example, engaged in carpentry to a much greater extent. I mean, they were in a sense still in a minority. There's the example of the architects. We've already heard about that today. So in your novel, you also chose to focus on an architect. Nonetheless, though, you were looking at that particular era and gender, but you wanted to look at the notion of a microcosmos and a world society. Perhaps you could present your point of view. You wrote a campus novel in a sense, did you not? Why did you decide to do that? Why did you write that format? Why did you choose to take that approach? Well, it's a campus novel as a genre, which is difficult in Germany because there aren't so many of these microcosmoses. They're not so isolated as they are, for example, in the US. In the Bauhaus, there were microcosmoses within the microcosmos. So we're looking at a group around Johannes Itten with a theosophical and esoteric thrust, perhaps picking up elements from the reform movement. There was lots of physical activity, gymnastics, and this notion of purification, of cleansing. And they were indeed esoteric and excluded others. The notion of the new man played a role as well. Johannes Itten made this even more specific, talking about a transparent race. Otto Mansar Hadush Hanish, that was his name, invented this particular esoteric school. It's not at all clear what his name really was and where he was born. It said he came from Tehran. He may actually have been born as a German in Posen. Otto Hanish may well have been his name. So there was this pseudo-internationalism. If you think about parallels with today, you can find that as well, left, right, and center. Take a look, for example, at yoga or organic food. You see the reform movement of those days once again turning up in various forms today. I often thought about this movement as a kind of neo-romanticism. There's a tendency to label it as being proto-fascist. And 23, having left the Bauhaus, it became more modern. I tried to make things more complex. For example, there's a problematic element of race teaching, but there's also the notion of forming communities, the communitarian element. And it's a very implicit policy. It's not spelled out explicitly at all. It's not something that really is expressed in an attitude to art and the notion of a shared uniform and so on and so forth. And one question now. You present the metropolis Berlin and set that in contrast to that universe. So is it the big city versus the provinces? Why did you select this twist? Well, the metropolis crops up later as well. The trick that I chose is perhaps a different one. The first part of the book has the contrast between technology and esoterics, the metropolis and the provinces. And in that respect, I just decided to divide it in two, in interest of the chronology, and set those one against another in the metropolis. The second section looks at Dessau and the international side of things and so on. That plays a greater role there.
So we heard before about the different fields and, you know, the subject and the subjective constructions that do exist. And, of course, in this modern building of Bauhaus, we've seen what these kind of trends were like. Now, in 1926, there was a moment, of course, when the Bauhaus building in Dessau was opened. Hans Gumbrecht wrote it, and it actually talks about this momentum of a change in an era. And he describes very nicely the different codes that get separated. So, you know, woman versus man, individuality, collective approaches, etc. And he also makes reference to a conversation of the 20s, heat versus cold. So Mazzanzan, of course, it was hot, but cold. Maybe it was cool to have a look at these cool students at the Bauhaus Dessau. So, and with Mark Wigley's presentation, we did see very nicely these cool personalities, this code of how to cut your hair and what type of clothes to wear, etc. So this was a, you know, dramatic performance, basically, and it had something to do with transgression. And so we had performance, the performance together with the building, and the facade was in the foreground. So this was something very modern, but it was anonymous. There was fragmentation, there was alienation, losses of cultural, local traditions and connections. A lot of philosophy oscillates between crisis scenarios on the one hand and objectivity on the other. So objectivity and relevance. So this is also a point of departure for our approach at that campus as an object and what the students have to do with it. And of course, we also heard a presentation where we found that, the glass skin, actually, the frame of this building actually plays a very important role for this healthy, youthful body and that is basically also expressed towards the outside where you cannot hide behind. So there are other images of the human being that are in contradiction to that. So there are certain normal tendencies, you know, standardized tendencies. But what we've heard before also was, you know, this cult of the body, the physical cult, which maybe is something that we have also seen arising later on in the 30s. So we have the fragmentation, we have the subject, we have the individual. Otibaga also made mention of that. You know, basically, I lost my ego, she said. And I think this is what is reflected very often also, you know, in the images, but also in the literature of this period of time. So I'm referring to this because this has something to do with the topic of campus to my mind as well. Then a world community. That did play a role also during the speech by the federal president. How come that the Bauhaus is so central to our minds even today? It had something to do, of course, with the masters, but it had something to do with the cosmopolitan view of it. And, you know, this new world that is being formed has something to do with the flow of forms. It has something to do, and it relates to the question of what type of technologies should be used, what type of transportation means were in existence, and what are the interfaces here. So on the other hand, however, this world community of the Bauhaus also was a club. It was a circuit as well, occupied by certain figures, certain personalities, mostly men. And this club was in flux towards the outside, towards the inside, but it was basically male-dominated. And this was a club, the Bauhaus Club, which meant you also needed to know Alfred Bauer, Philip Johnson, so that you had an international club, so to speak. And when the Bauhaus closed and then later the emigrations started to happen, and of course, you know, exile was a problematic term for the prominent or the protagonists, but that was supported. Patrick Dorsten also mentioned this because it was something in flux. You know, this structure, the club structure of the Bauhaus actually was in flux. But there were always places to actually come up with a new footing the world over. And of course, there was the network of the exhibitions the world over. That was one thing that was mentioned also during the presentations earlier. And that clubhouse, that is always something, you know, exclusive, that is something that is given to an elite, and it is something that is exclusive of other people. This is something we need to bear in mind. This type of network I'm referring to also led to canonization and to the telling of the history of the Bauhaus to a certain degree. So being in flux, different composition, then the major exhibitions that form a platform, a node, so to speak, in 1938 and 68 also, you know, with the exhibition in Stuttgart. So basically there is a club history written along these lines between those who belong and those who don't. And we can also say that there was a depoliticization of Bauhaus under National Socialism, of course, but also the role of Hannes Meyer that was mentioned before. There's also another story that I would like to refer to as my last point, internationalization of policy of remembrance. So this is the momentum of getting the UNESCO World Heritage status, and that also has something to do with the media relation. Basically, there's this one image of the Bauhaus that is well known all over the world, and this also has something to do. It was a contribution and was made more prominent even by the UNESCO status. So you take a look at the buildings, you take a look at the protocols, you see a difference there. But what remains is a dramatic and complicated story of and history of the buildings on the ground. And that reflects all these adventures and also the dramas of the past century, denunciation efforts that go into reorganizing that building, you know, creating a cultural center, then the GDR period for the Bauhaus used to be like a cultural house, cultural edifice, basically, where workshops did take place later on. So it's a very exciting story that has evolved over time. And, of course, there is dispute, of course, also on the heritage of Bauhaus. And that has not stopped. It does occur even to this very day. And it is being done. The dispute is going on basically up to this very day, and not only in one country, but all over the world. And we are trying to cope with it.